From the Firebird Radio Studio, it's the Authors on Fire podcast with nationally syndicated radio host and producer, Pat Rulo.
Welcome to the Authors on Fire podcast, part of Speak Up Talk Radio's many services, home to the International Firebird Book Awards, the Positive Change Podcast Awards Hall of Fame, and our newest book song, where we create a musical masterpiece to highlight your book. I am Pat Rulo, and today's a good day because I have a Firebird Book Award winner to share with you, Phoebe Gabriel, and her award-winning book is called No Ordinary Love. She is an award-winning Canadian author and master's-level registered social worker who transforms trauma into stories of survival, resilience, and hope. She writes to heal and to help others do the same. And in today's conversation, we are going to explore her powerful new book, No Ordinary Love, which shares the true stories of three women surviving intimate partner violence. Now, these stories don't just reveal the scars left by their abusers, but they also reveal the strength it takes to say no more. And perhaps we'll explore Bibi's own journey as a survivor, what it means to break the silence, and how society can do better in supporting living through abuse. So hang on, this episode is about courage, survival, and the power of finally being heard. Welcome to the Authors on Fire podcast, Bibi.
Thank you, Pat. I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Oh, gosh, that is my pleasure to have you here. Makes my day. And congratulations on winning the Firebird Book Award. That's always happy news for me to share.
Thank you. Yes, it is. Actually, my niece, her name is Phoenix, and so she is a Firebird. And when I didn't even tell her, actually, she noticed it, and she got so excited, and she said, "You won my award." I said, "Yeah, I did."
All righty. So let's just dig right into your book. Maybe share a little bit, I kind of gave a little tease up top, about No Ordinary Love and what it's about and perhaps what inspired you to write about it.
Yeah. Okay. It's a lot to unpack. So No Ordinary Love is my own fictionalized memoir. I say fictionalized, that's very like a very loose term. It's my own real story. I had to say fictionalized because I created dialogue, which of course, without a recorder for my whole life, you can't be totally accurate. And I also play with time a little bit. It was really important to me to try to show three different stages or phases of going through intimate partner violence. So right in the thick of it, and then about 10 years out, and then about 20 years out, to show that for those of us who are able to leave successfully and safely, it doesn't end there. It continues on. And so, it's my story. And the title, No Ordinary Love, is from the Sade song. However, although it first was about, I used it because it was mine and my abusive partner's song, and I thought that was pretty, you know, accurate, I guess. It actually turned into being more about the No Ordinary Love of my family, and then also of and for myself. And so the title kind of evolved with writing the book as well.
So that title has several lives, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
It's a great song, by the way, too.
It is.
Oh, wow. So a fictionalized, but not really, memoir. The book is obviously raw and deeply personal. What was the hardest part about putting these stories down on the page?
Yeah, great question. I would say the hardest part was having to call it a fiction. So that's why I started in on it's a fictionalized memoir, but not really. And the very specific things that make it fiction, I had to get legal counsel about this. And I had to figure out what I needed to tweak or change slightly to protect myself. But it really felt like I was protecting my abuser, to be honest. So I would say that was the hardest part, was where I had to finally, at first I was calling it a creative nonfiction, and I'm not a writer by by trade, I get, well, I guess maybe I'm moving into that more now, but I wasn't when I started this. And so I was told like, well, no, it doesn't really fit with creative nonfiction. It doesn't really fit with that. I said, well, I'm not calling it a fiction. It's not a fiction. It's my real life. And it was like, well, your writing style and the arc of the story and this and that and whatever, and the fact that you're recreating dialogue. So it's not a true memoir. And so yeah, that was the hardest part for me. So that's why I make it very clear right off the bat that if you were to dive into what is actually fictionalized, I think people would be surprised. It's really that I play with time and I recreate dialogue. So that would be the hardest. I think I wrote it over, it depends on when you start counting. I wrote it over many years. The very first thing that I ever wrote was when I was I was away from my abuser, but not for long. I didn't know that at the time, obviously. And I wrote something for a high school creative writing class. And parts of that are still in this book. So if we say that that's when I technically started writing about it, then that would be over 2 decades ago. But it was really a difficult thing to write. So I picked it up and put it down and picked it up and put it down. And what gave me the idea to write a novel was when I was doing my undergraduate degrees. I was doing psychology and social work, and I was learning about these types of things, about trauma, about intimate partner violence, about PTSD. And I thought, well, why? I'm reading all these other people's, you know, case studies and kind of unpacking them, but I have my own. So what if I use this as a way to kind of understand my own experience and also to kind of heal myself, because I didn't have access to money for therapy. And to be honest, I didn't even understand what I'd gone through enough. It was so confusing. And I carried so much shame that wasn't mine to carry, let's be clear. But at the time I was carrying it, and I was embarrassed, and I didn't know how to understand it, unpack it, share it. And so I started writing about, I kind of externalized a part of myself, and I called her Katie, and I started writing about her experiences as case studies for my university degrees.
You know, survivors, you say, they often carry shame or fear that silences them. So I was going to ask you what gave you the courage to finally say no more and speak out, but it sounds like that kind of evolved as you were studying about it. You realized, oh my, I have a story to tell, and let me do this. Was there ever any time where you thought, yeah, I'll put this on paper, but it's just for me? What made you think I have to get this out there into the public?
Yeah, another great question, Pat. At the beginning, I didn't say it was me. Even my university professors, who the one that made the biggest impact on my life, she actually did the foreword for my book. I found her and all these years later and said, you probably don't remember me, but this is, and she did. She did remember who I was. And she didn't know that I was writing about myself, of course, because I used a different name. And so I didn't speak up and wave my hands and say, I'm writing about myself. That took a long time. I knew that I wanted to get there one day. I had faith that I would be, I don't even want to say brave enough. I mean, part of it was being brave, but part of it was safety. This person, I don't even know if, I think he might be deceased, but I don't know for sure. I even tried to hire private investigators, and I kind of do my own reverse stalking, if you will, on social media stuff to try to keep an eye out to see where he might be. But the feeling safe enough to share, that came over time, and decades, and moving so many times, and being in a healthy, safe relationship with somebody that I feel could protect me. And that was it was an evolution. And technically still, because I go by BB Gabriel, as my author name, and also what you're referring to me now, that's still me staying kind of one step back, you know? So yeah, that's a tricky question to answer.
Well, it's a complicated situation, and therefore any solution you come up with is going to be somewhat equally as complicated, I would think.
Exactly.
Yep. So your three characters, Gabby, Alex, and Katie, are in very different stages of abuse. Yeah. What do you hope that your readers learn from seeing those different journeys side by side?
Yeah, exactly. Thank you for asking that. There's a lot that's out there that I've read myself, and obviously lots I haven't read, where it talks about when you're in the thick of it, or maybe when you're just leaving, or at the very, very beginning of leaving. And I feel like, there's a question, a frustrating question for those of us who have been in the thick of it. It's like, why did you stay? And that question has a lot of work that's been done around it to be answered and explained, and to try to get the people who have been blessed enough, and I truly believe it's luck, to not find themselves in situations like this, at least yet, to try to understand a little bit more about all of the what's the word I'm looking for? Barriers that impact a person's ability to leave and leave safely and whatever else. But I don't see a lot where we're talking about the impact that intimate partner violence has on its victims, survivors, thrivers over the years after. And so I really wanted to be able to show that in a way where I weaved those three stories, in and out of one another, to show that just because Alex is 10 years out, she is not safe. Her abuser is still contacting her. He's contacting her from jail and then from out of jail. And she is not safe. It is impacting where she lives, where she works. And then Gabby is about 20 years out. And Gabby still, although we're not sure where the abuser may or may not be, it's showing that depending on where she travels in the world, depending on what smells she smells, sights she sees, sounds she hears, she still is taken right back to that place from 2 decades before and still does not feel safe because she doesn't know where he is. And so I thought it was a really important thing to show. Obviously, when you're in the thick of reading about the details of intimate partner violence, it causes visceral responses in lots of us, even people who haven't been through it. But I think that showing those same responses in characters who are so many years out is something that's really not understood very well. And I wanted to be able to showcase that as best I could.
Again, a complicated thing to answer because most people do feel that's, why didn't she just leave? And so is there a better question people should be asking, or is it not a question?
Yeah, I think the question is, why do people abuse?
Ah.
Why do they abuse? Why don't they leave if they're so miserable and unhappy and need so much control that they're not getting and feel that they're not big enough or important enough that they need to take it out on other people? Why don't they move on? Why don't they leave? Why do they abuse? Why don't they get help? Like, I think we need to put it back on the perpetrators. I think we need to put the questions and the shame and the blame and the everything else on them, not on, and I'm trying very carefully not to just say women or men, because it happens, it can happen to anybody. But I think that that's where we need to focus the attention and the questions and everything else, is on why people abuse other people or animals.
Yes. Oh, wow. That's a good answer to that question. And I don't know how society, we need to also hold society accountable. So that's a question that society as a group should be thinking about. So with that in mind, it, like turning the tables to the abuser or the perpetrator, what can communities, schools, and workplaces, friends do better to support exactly what you're talking about?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think part of why this is a tricky, complicated thing to do is that people have many parts, I mean, that's literally how I structured my book, is different parts. And abusers or perpetrators do as well. These are people who they can lead otherwise normal lives and hold jobs, and sometimes they're in the media or the public eye themselves. And so a lot of people are seeing these what appear to be well-rounded, kind, helpful, intelligent, good-looking, charming, whatever people, and it's really hard to believe that parts of them could be capable of something more sinister, or just sinister in general. And so I think I'm pulling it away from the abusers and perpetrators again, but I think first and foremost, this is why it's so essential to believe victims. If somebody there, what are we gaining from putting up our hand and saying, oh my goodness, this is happening to me. I need help. Believe me, help me, support me. Mm-hmm. What do we have to gain from that? It's embarrassing. It's confusing. These are things that are really hard to speak up about and ask for help about and shine light on. These victims, we have nothing to gain from saying these awful things happened to me. So I think first and foremost, we need to believe and hold space for people and listen when they say that there's a problem and take a step back and try to get a better understanding and grasp of the whole situation and remember that people, all people, every single one of us have parts, you know? And just because we're not seeing a certain part of what somebody is and what they're capable of does not mean that it's not there.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's almost like a horror movie if you think about it from what you were saying just a few moments ago about, you know, people not knowing, is this person dead? Is this person alive? Are they around the corner? Are they here? Are they there? Are they watching me? Clearly, the abuse does not end when the relationship does. What can be done, if anything, to better protect those survivors, if you want to call it survivors, from this ongoing harassment or danger? Is there anything?
Yeah, I mean, these are fantastic questions that are asked all the time. What can we do? And like I said, I think it really starts with believing and making it a bit easier and less confusing to be able to, well, yes, the belief comes first, to be able to get things like restraining orders or emergency protection orders, or that, you know, to be able to protect yourself that way. But those things are not easy and they're not simple. And oftentimes they're not granted. And, you know, I just want to touch on something you'd mentioned, that this sounds like a real life horror, real life thriller. And that's exactly what it is. I find it really interesting that when what people are watching on Netflix, what they're reading in books, when we can say that, hide behind saying that it's fiction, then it can be fan favorites and people can't get enough of it. And, you know, they want to read all the gore and the horror and be scared and whatever else. But when we say that it's a real story, that it really happened to somebody, especially if it's somebody that we know, then all of a sudden it makes us uncomfortable and we can't really go there. And I think that's really interesting, because no matter what fictional story we're listening to or reading or watching, it's most likely happened time and time again to real people, right? Just because we're making up characters in a story and it didn't happen to those actual people doesn't mean it's not happening in real life. So I think it's really something to question, that we're so comfortable hiding behind the title of fiction. Oh. But comfortable when it comes to, like, no, this is my real life. This happened to me. You know me. And I experienced this with my book, how hard it was for people who know me to read my book and to know that it happened to me. And my message was, well, you're lucky, because I'm okay. I'm actually better than okay. I am thriving. And you know that. You get to see how I turned out. You get to see who I am now. That's not the case for a lot of other people and a lot of the other stories that we see on TV or read about in books. So you actually have, you know, something positive where you know that I turned out okay. That's not the same case for everybody.
Now I can see why you don't want to call the book fiction. It kind of loses some of its impact just because of what expectations are of fiction.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know, about the fiction thing, I had a phenomenal, brilliant editor, but we did not see eye to eye on many things. I think, I don't know, I didn't ask, but it kind of seemed like she just didn't really get it. And a lot of people don't. But one of the things she kept saying to me was like, well, you can't just have the story end, you know, here, or you can't just have Katie like not do anything, or you can't just have Alex. And I'm like, but this is a real story. I can't just make that up because it follows the arc of, yes, you know, the story that you think I'm writing. Like, this is my real life. These things actually happened, and I can't just make it better somehow. Like, one of the things that she kept pointing out was, she was like, you know, nobody's going to like Katie because she doesn't have enough advocacy for herself. She can't, like, we need to see her do something. And I'm like, well, guess what? In real life, That's not how it happens. And I can't just add that. And yes, she does. She does enough. She does what she can. Like, for the listeners that haven't read the book, obviously, Katie is a high school student. She's 17 years old, and she's with an Ephebophile, a man who is 31 years old when they first meet. So, I mean, regardless of her age, even if she was in her 40s or 50s, this would be a complicated, almost impossible situation to deal with, escape from, heal from. But when you add on the extra layer of her age, like, so no, she did the best that she could. And this is not a fiction. This is a real life. And just because we're calling it a fictionalized memoir does not mean that I'm going to change facts to fit the arc of a story, you know?
Wow, good for you.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, good for you for standing up for what was right.
Thanks.
So, as your readers close your book, what do you hope they will feel or take away?
Yeah, many things. I hope that for other, survivors, wherever they are on their healing journey, whether they're still surviving or thriving or victims or whatever, I hope that they see themselves in those pages. It's an audiobook too, so hear themselves, whatever. I hope that they feel seen, heard, understood, validated, Many of us can't speak up. It took me, decades to be able to speak up, and I'm still kind of hiding behind a layer of protection. And so I understand why not everybody can, and it's not safe to do so. And so I hope that other survivors and thrivers feel like I did them justice, and that they can see and hear their story in mine. I hope that people who have been blessed enough to never have gone through this, because I truly believe it's the perfect storm can come for anybody. And I really hope that they get a better understanding of how layered it is, how complicated it is, how hard it is, and that they can be a little bit more compassionate and be a little bit more curious and believe a little bit more if and when they have somebody in their life, because chances are pretty good that they do. One in three or one in four, depending on where you live in the world and what your gender is, people have been through something like this. And sexual assault is a whole other topic. And so that they can be a little bit more compassionate, patient, understanding, curious, supportive, when somebody has the courage to reach out and share their story. My book at the beginning is there's a bunch of resources, first for people who are Canadian like me, and then worldwide ones. So I have that in there. I really think that I didn't want to just share my story and have nowhere to go for people who needed something. So there's that too, even for people who might know somebody, that there are resources that are right in there. Yeah, and I hope that people can find their own way in their own time to use their voice, even if it is still, writing about it like it happened to somebody else, externalizing that part of themselves and giving it a different name, like that they find a way to get it out. Because for me, that process was so deeply therapeutic, I cannot even tell you. That's how the book eventually came to be, was writing about it in my two undergraduate degrees and then eventually in my graduate degree. I realized how healing it was for me to just get it out and for me to be able to see it from a more healed version of myself. It was like writing letters to my younger self. And that's actually how I structured the book initially. That changed because of my editor, but it was really about me writing what had happened and then responding from a more healed place as a more healed person, and with my education and experience and whatever else. So I hope that people can take that away too, that you don't have to have your face in front of a camera on TV, and like you and I don't even have cameras on right now, right? So there are ways that you can get your story out, even if you never share it with anybody else, even if it's just for you. I wrote and I wrote and I wrote and I rewrote, rewrote, rewrote. I read and I reread, and I just kept doing it until it didn't impact me as much anymore, until I was able to read it more easily, and then eventually that I was able to share it.
So cathartic to write about whatever trauma you are going through, again, whether it's for some, ultimately for someone else, really it is for yourself first and foremost, as a healing mechanism. And as you're speaking, I'm also thinking about the layers of readers. There's going to be those who have experienced similar and could help, maybe help guide them and find a way out. But even more importantly, I'm thinking you mentioned those who were blessed to never have experienced something like this. It's almost a duty after reading your book to give this some thought. And we talked about accountability and how society needs to be, can help by being accountable. Maybe each person who reads your book who never experienced this can take it upon themselves to say, you know, I'm going to be accountable for this if and when it crosses my path, or maybe I'm going to look for places where I can assist with this kind of situation. I think it's a real opportunity for everybody to come away and be an improved person.
Yep, I totally agree 100%.
So what's next for you, my friend? Are you writing a somewhat a sequel? Is it going to be similar, or where are you going?
Honestly, I have so many ideas. This process, the actual writing process, and well, not the writing, but the publishing really process, and it's a lot. It's a lot. And I have many things that I wanted to do, but I don't know. I do have two things I'm working on right now. One is a short story that is in an anthology. Mm-hmm. So that'll be coming out toward the end of the year. And it's about grief. So my little sister died 3 years ago, and I was trying to get my novel done in time for her to read, and that didn't happen. And out of that came some writing that I was doing on grief, because, I mean, how can I say that it helped me and healed me to write about my intimate partner violent experience and then not think that I could, you know, do the same thing for my grief. Mm-hmm. And so I wrote a short story about that and a tattoo that my other sister and I got that has to do with that. And then I also have written, the illustrations are done, my part's done. I'm just waiting for the interior layout to be done. So I'm hoping to have it out for my little sister's birthday. She would have turned 40 on November 20th. So that's the goal, to have it published for that date. And it is about grief and just how to reframe it, instead of seeing it as something to avoid and something that's uncomfortable and something that we try to, you know, pack away and not deal with, to see it as an opportunity to meet our loved ones and to see it as a time that we're really is scheduling almost like a meeting with them, and that they're there with us when we're going through all of that. And just reframing it. So those are the next two things. The one is called We'll Meet You. And then the second one, like I said, it's just a short story in an anthology, but my part is called The Three Sisters, Valleys and Mountains. And the book that it's in is actually called Resilient AF, Skin Deep Stories. And so I'm working with this phenomenal woman. She's Canadian as well. And she has written, I think, three books called Resilient AF, and they're about all sorts of different types of resiliency. But the one that we're working on right now that I'm a part of is about tattoos that people have gotten to kind of tell the story of something that they were, that they demonstrated resiliency for. And so mine is part of that.
Oh my, I love this. I can't wait to read these books, anthologies. There's something really special. I've hosted a couple anthologies, and it's just such a neat way to get your voice heard that doesn't take, you know, years to write, and you're in the company of a lot of other excellent authors and messages. So I look forward to all of that. You'll have to keep us posted on that. All right. Anything we missed that you wanted to highlight today?
I don't think so. I'm just so grateful for this opportunity to share. And not that I can think of. Can you think of anything? You've done such a job.
I could probably talk to you all day, but not a good idea for those listening. Maybe we'll have to do this again sometime. Well, maybe after your next book. How's that?
Yeah. Absolutely.
If you would then share all of your contact information, where can folks find you and get copies of your books?
Yeah, so my book is available like anywhere that books are sold. So Amazon, as much as people like to buy, boycott that, that's actually the best place, you know, for me, in one, because you can leave reviews, and reviews are really what is the most helpful thing that you can do for authors. So you can get it through Amazon. It's available on audio, ebook, also obviously paperback, but it's also available on, in Canada, we mainly use Indigo Chapters, but you guys in the States have Barnes and Noble, and it's available online at those stores. Not a lot of in-store copies, but they will deliver it to you or to the store. And then I have a website that is myauthorname.com. So www.bbgabriel.com. And I have an Instagram handle for my book, which is @no_ordinary_love_BB_Gabriel. I really should have rethought that because it's quite long, but that's what it is. And then I have TikTok, which I don't use as much. It's really hard for me to get used to it. But I do have something, and there's lots on there too. And it is the same as my Instagram handle, except for taking away the .Gabriel at the end. So it's just @no_ordinary_love_BB. And I think that's about it. On my website, like, there's information to be able to contact me via email and stuff. So I've done lots of podcasts, and now this radio interview. And so if anybody, I've actually spoken to a graduate level university class. So I'm open to discussing speaking opportunities, depending on what they are. And I'm just happy to get the word out there and help in my own little way. So you can find me through the website.
Excellent. I was just thinking, a great book club pick, right?
Absolutely. I actually have I think it's actually on my website, or maybe it says contact me for more, because I wrote this like book club pitch on why it would be a good choice, and some kind of conversation, starter discussion kind of questions. And so, yeah, reach out to me on the website if you would like me to send you that.
Righty. No Ordinary Love is more than just a book, as you can tell. It is a lifeline, and a reminder that survivors are not alone. So if you or someone you know is experiencing abuse, please, please reach out for help. Resources are available. There's some in the book, and there is a way forward, as you can tell from this inspiring conversation today. Bebe, thank you so much for your honesty and your courage in sharing these stories with us today. I've so enjoyed my time with you.
I have too, Pat. Thanks so much. I really appreciate the opportunity.